Well, I guess the first question is, why a book about the Beatles versus the Stones?
I've been fascinated by both bands since I was a kid. Like a lot of young children, I discovered my parents' Beatles records. And so I was a Beatles fan when I was very young, and then a little older, I became a Stones fan. And when I was researching my last book, Smoking Typewriters, which was on the underground press in the 60s and 70s, I came across a lot of really neat primary source material. They were articles about the Beatles and the Stones and their different political standpoints in the very late 60s. And so the research for my first book led to my second one. It was a really interesting debate that young people were having then.
You did not experience Beatlemania firsthand, though.
I was born too late.
The rivalry between the Beatles and the Stones was originally driven in large part by the teen magazines, the fanzines at the time, right?
Right. There was, but not also tabloids in England, the British tabloids, really played up the rivalry and the idea that the Beatles were the cuddly mop tops that were appropriate for children, and the Stones were the more dangerous, edgy band.
Early in your book, you quote the writer, the London writer, Sean O'Mahony, who says, you know, in reality, where the Beatles are being portrayed as friendly and polite, and the Stones are the bad boys of rock, in their real life, it was almost the opposite.
Yeah, to a large extent. You know, the Beatles were working class kids growing up in Liverpool, and especially when they were in Germany, when they were sort of burnishing their chops as a young band, you know, they got into a lot of trouble, and so they had the pills and the groupies, and sometimes they would get in fights and everything else. And, you know, the Rolling Stones were, well, Mick Jagger and Brian Jones were grammar school kids. And Mick Jagger, of course, he went to the London School of Economics briefly, a very selective school. And this was at a time when only about 2% of British kids even went on to college. And Brian Jones was an outstanding student as well. And they were, you know, upper middle class, and they had better prospects in that sort of, you know, rigidly segmented society.
You know, even to this day, and it sort of rankles me a little bit, people refer to the Beatles as the original boy band.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a term of endearment.
No, it's not. John Lennon, especially, of all the Beatles, was rankled by the idea that, you know, they had to wear these suits and bow and conform and be polite. And, you know, he put up with it because that was the way to be successful, and that's what he wanted above all. But I think if he could have had gone along with an image that was a little truer to his bohemian origins, he would have gone that route.
You have a number of photographs in the book, and one that I'd never seen is a photograph of the Rolling Stones early on, where they look like, well, they look like the Beatles. They look like Hermits for crying out loud. They got the ties on, they got the smiling faces, they're posing like that. That image didn't last very long, did it?
No, but it's interesting because very briefly, a lot of people don't know this, you know, their original approach was to style themselves just like the Beatles with matching suits, and they were going to smile and have acceptable hair and everything else. But that didn't last too long. I mean, very quickly, someone would forget to wear their vest or their tie or something like this. And they started acting in a more surly or defiant way. And the people seemed to like that. And so they sort of moved in a different direction. And under the influence of their manager, Andrew Luke Oldham, they decided to style themselves as the anti-Beatles. And they'd be just a little more surly and defiant and everything else.
One thing I was not aware of is that in the early days, the Beatles' appeal was primarily to young girls. I mean, that's a given for pretty much any pop band at the time. But the Stones really attracted a male audience, largely.
People forget, first of all, just how young the Beatles fan base was. And in England, you know, I mean, they had won approval from all segments of society, parents like them and politicians and even the British royal family. But their main base of appeal was with, you know, very young teenage girls. And the Stones were different. They had kind of an art school crowd. And, you know, for the first time, you were seeing a lot of, you know, young male teens going to see the Stones.
The idea of creating a rivalry between bands, I recall, having lived through Beatlemania personally, in early 64, when the Beatles performed on Ed Sullivan for 3 Sundays in a row, shortly thereafter, a band out of Britain called the Dave Clark Five was on. And they were able to crank out 4 or 5 top 20 hits in the next few months. It was really like a year and a half in the U.S. anyway between the time the Beatles' first big hit, I Want to Hold Your Hand, reached the top of the charts, and Satisfaction by the Stones. So in the meantime, you've got, I remember seeing fan magazines showing this rivalry between the Dave Clark Five and the Beatles.
Right.
And is the DC Five going to knock the Beatles out of the number one spot and all that?
Mm-hmm.
And that went on for several months. And then Jerry and the Pacemakers. And there was always another band to go up against the Beatles.
So, yeah. it's surprising to think about that, because the Dave Clark Five just haven't had the enduring, you know, appeal of the Stones or the Beatles, obviously. But that's exactly right. The Beatles always felt that there was another band coming up, and the media was always looking to see who was going to knock the Beatles off the top of the charts. And it wasn't always the Stones.
The rivalry between the Beatles and the Stones was largely manufactured. The members of the bands themselves got along. They became friends.
To a large degree, sure. They would socialize, and they had a lot of shared experiences, and they both members of both groups appreciated what the other one was doing. And there was a lot of overlap in their musical tastes. But I think that also there was some, you know, sense of competition for record sales, for aesthetic credibility, for cultural influence. And sometimes there were some tensions. I think that the Beatles felt that the Rolling Stones would sometimes imitate them or follow their lead. And John Lennon seemed especially aggrieved by that at times. And I think, you know, I think Mick Jagger seemed, you know, there's a lot of quotes that seem to suggest that he was a little jealous of just the Beatles for their commercial success.
And Brian Jones, too, seemed to be very envious of what the Beatles were doing. And an interesting passage in your book recounts when Brian Jones first heard Love Me Do with a harmonica on it.
Uh-huh.
He was over the top going, oh, my gosh. How can they do that? How can they use a harmonica like that when that's what we do? Because we're an R&B band.
Well, yeah, he was a real purist. And when he was first starting out, his whole thing was about being, you know, a kind of a revivalist for, you know, the American electric blues. And he wanted to bring that scene, you know, into England. And I don't think that he really thought of himself as being a huge, successful, sexy pop star. I don't think that was the original intention. But the Beatles did become successful. I don't think the Beatles sounded a lot like the Stones when they were first getting going, but there was the harmonica, and the Beatles were kind of a model for the kind of success that the Rolling Stones later decided they wanted to have. And that was a big conflict in Brian Jones's thinking.
This back and forth that was developed in the early days between the Stones and the Beatles was then became played out in public. It was manifested, when Sgt. Pepper's came out, the Beatles' iconic album, I'll call it that, with the doll on the front that says, "Welcome, Rolling Stones." And then the Stones responded with Satanic Majesty's Request, the title of which almost is like, oh, yeah? Mm-hmm. So you're Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band? Well, we're satanic. And then on the cover of that, you know, I've got the original album that has that 3D type thing. There is little photographs of Beetleheads stuck in the flowers.
If you tilt it, it sort of has a 3D effect with a Japanese camera. And if you tilt it in various directions, you can see the Beatles. So, yeah, that was both bands were making sort of a wink and a nod to each other with their record covers.
And if you saw the All You Need Is Love television broadcast, the live broadcast, who's on the stage singing with the Beatles?
Mick Jagger is sort of on the floor,
right.
You know, sort of clapping along and singing. It's an interesting image because Mick Jagger's sort of gazing up at the Beatles as if they're sort of acolytes.
Everything seemed to change, though, as far as the Beatles' image and their involvement in different social issues after Brian Epstein died. He really was the wizard behind the curtain for them, wasn't he?
He was, and the Beatles had a lot of problems after he died. You know, for a long time, Brian Epstein was trying to persuade the Beatles not to get involved in any controversies about the Vietnam War or civil rights or whatnot. And for the most part, the Beatles kept their feelings private. But certainly after Brian Epstein passed away, they became a little more vocal. And they, you know, allowed their personal image to change a bit. They became very, very immersed in the youth culture and the vibe of the hippie counterculture and those aesthetics.
And the Rolling Stones, did they follow suit, or were they heading off in their own direction that way also?
Well, at the same time that the Beatles were associated with this sort of gentle radicalism of the counterculture, the Rolling Stones seemed to telegraph that they were interested in the kind of the new left politics, the politics of confrontation and street fighting and militants that a lot of young people were enamored with around, you know, the summer of 1968, for example.
I think what's different, and I may be going out on a limb here, between pop music acts, if I can use that term, of the 60s and what exists today, is that the effect the Beatles had was really far beyond music on the youth at the time. Yeah, it started out as songs, but then because of the appearance, and so many young people look to the Beatles for a lot more than a song that's going to make me feel good.
Mm-hmm.
They became the embodiment of, in many ways, of the youth movement, which was all about, you know, independence and freedom and being good to the environment. There's a long list of social issues that they became identified with, whether they wanted to or not, I guess.
No, I think that's really well put. A lot of young people felt that they had some you know, commonality of outlook and purpose with the Beatles. They would look to the Beatles for, you know, signs about how they should behave or orient themselves towards the world. And the Beatles just had a profound cultural impact on a lot of young people.
I'm still struck by the way the Beatles looked when they were playing in Germany in the early 60s compared to how they ended up looking not even a year and a half, 2 years later after Epstein gets a hold of them. I mean, it's like this amazing metamorphosis. And I've got to wonder, were they just naive enough or innocent enough to think, well, this guy knows what we need to do to make us really big?
When I teach courses on the 60s, sometimes I'll show pictures of the Beatles in 1962 and then 1968, or I'll play Please Please Me and then a song from, you know, the Revolver record, Tomorrow Never Knows, let's say, just to give people a sense of the tremendous change that took place in the way that they looked, the way they styled themselves, the way they sounded. You know, in just a few years, there's a massive transformation in how they constituted themselves. And of course, as we were just saying, a lot of people look to the Beatles as you know, leaders of this youth movement.
As the Beatles went off in different directions after Epstein died, that eventually culminated in Sgt. Pepper's and the White Album and the later Beatles image, I think most in the youth movement thought they were really spearheading this on their own in that they're coming up with these ideas, when in reality, a lot of it was they were being exposed to influences that already had those ideas, whether it's the Maharishi or something else, right?
Yeah, that's right. The Beatles got involved in sort of a hip bohemian left-wing crowd. And, you know, and they had taken LSD, I think, in 1965 for the first time. You know, this is before most people even knew what marijuana smelled like in the United States. So they were sort of in the vanguard of this cultural renaissance, if you will.
So as you're doing your research on a band that you've professed that you like since you were 10, and the Stones, too, that you're a fan of, anything really, really shock you or surprise you?
Well, when I did my research, as much as possible, I tried to use primary sources. There's so many biographies that have been written about both groups. And I tried to go to newspapers, the underground newspapers that we mentioned, the fan magazines and interviews, and tried to use primary sources as much as possible. And that helped me, I guess, to, you know, bring some new material to light that doesn't really appear in a lot of the main books. But I was so familiar with both groups, I can't say I was, you know, really shocked by anything. Although I learned some interesting tidbits. I learned that the Beatles, you know, three of the four Beatles grew up in homes that didn't have running water. And I thought that was really odd. And then I realized that they were in Liverpool, and that city had been bombed so much during World War II that it wasn't actually as unusual as it may seem. And John Lennon once, when he was a kid, the schoolmaster was very upset with him, and he wanted him to think about what careers he could maybe have that he would be well-suited for. And when John Lennon was in primary school, he thought maybe he was going to be a salmon fisherman. That's the career he was looking towards.
Well, you ask in the very beginning of the book, you pose the question, Beatles or Stones? And, you know, to a lot of people, it might be apples and oranges, but where do your preferences lie?
I do have a preference, but I actually don't state it in the book. And
I know you don't. Well, I'm asking. come clean.
I don't want, you know, the book is a joint biography, and it's about how the bands interrelated personally and how this rivalry was constructed by fans and by the media and to some degree by the groups themselves. And so I don't want to get sidetracked into a debate about which band I think is better. That's a little bit beside the point of what I'm trying to do. And I think it would cause people to lose focus on the work that I'm trying to do. Lots of other scholars and critics have, you know, weighed in on this debate in various ways.
John McMillan, the author of Beatles versus Stones. John, a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much.